The boy genius, finding him again through the patriarchal group. That seems to be is that a new social phenomenon or maybe an old one? I'm pleased that Tony Esselin is here to talk to us about that topic. He is a senior editor for Touchstone and very prolific author, many books, many columns. He pops up all over, writes. A few years ago when I saw how much he was writing, I just thought, oh, he just can't keep doing that. You know, he's probably, you know, just getting it all off his chest and out there. And that was probably 10 years ago when I thought he can't keep doing it, so he's still doing it. He teaches English now at Thomas More College in Merrimack, New Hampshire, and as I mentioned, is the author of many books, and many of them are back on the table there. His new book is coming out called Nostalgia, Going Home in a Homeless World, and that will be available at the end of October. That title itself, just so much the idea of the return to the father's house and the prodigal son, I mean, that says it all. I'm sure a few people in the audience here will probably be reading your book, I'm sure. I will be. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Anthony Esselin.
Thank you, Jim. I have to thank Touchstone also, because if it weren't for Touchstone, I wouldn't be here. They were the first magazine back in the fall of 2003 to publish anything that I'd written in that vein, a freelance article on boys, in fact, it was. So much of what happened afterwards to me or for me, I owed directly to Touchstone magazine. And it's a debt that I can't repay. It's a tremendous debt. Before I begin, I would like to say I'm here in a little bit of trepidation because of the three fine talks that I heard yesterday. I came in the middle of the afternoon, so I heard Pastor Wiley's talk, and my brain is not working, but what I wanted to, and Nancy Piercy's talk, but I wanted to give a special shout out, I'm not sure if he's here, to Father Jacobsy for delivering the finest sermon that I've ever heard in my life. And please do applaud. I told my wife about it last night on the telephone. He says, I've never heard a sermon as fine as that in all my life. And I've been privileged to hear quite a few good sermons, too. I guess I want to start by noting something that everybody is actually aware of, that boys in our time are not succeeding particularly well in school. I am sometimes startled by the lack of self-awareness of feminists who illegitimately say, or people generally on the left, illegitimately say that this group over here must perform exactly as well as that group over there, without taking into account such things as family structure, income, where you grew up, what your surroundings are, and so forth. But in the case of the two groups where the family income, the schools, where you grew up, and so on, are exactly the same, we're talking about brothers and sisters come from the same families, and the boys not succeeding these days, as well as their sisters, then it's absolute silence, stony silence. That boys should dislike school is not a new thing in the world. But the sheer carelessness with which this dislike of school is treated, the almost pleasure that I detect among some feminists to note that boys are not doing well, that's a new thing in the world, okay? So I would like to defend boys here and to promote their interests. Lately, lately I've made a hobby. This is one of the ways I waste time, I'm afraid. I go to a website that's one of those things where, you know, it's online, and so you know that. It's a very fine website. Not surprising because of the subject matter at the website. It's totally unpolitical. It's a place where you can see how great chess games were once played. And you can learn about the lives and the habits of the most illustrious masters of the game. So this means that I've come into contact with quite a few boy geniuses, as they used to be called. We used to have different boy genius. You may recognize some of their names. Everybody, I think, in America should probably recognize the name of Bobby Fischer, Jose Raul Capablanca, Mikhail Tal, and my favorite among them is 19th century American lad named Paul Morphy. He's one of the best players of his day, Morphy's day, said that losing to Paul Morphy for the first time was like your first experience of an electrical shock. I guess we've all had experiences of that. I had an experience. I was repairing a small appliance when my, as we now know, we didn't know at the time, my autistic son, at age 3, would go around plugging things in that had not been plugged in, and behind my back, he plugged in the appliance that I was working on just as I was stripping the wire to it with my teeth. There was some creative swearing next few minutes, and needless to say, I mean, this is a difference between men and women, needless to say, my wife was angry with me for swearing at my son. Anyway, your first experience of an electric shock is not going to be particularly pleasant. It has no relation to anything you have ever felt before. It's not so much painful. It wasn't painful for me, though. I had to use a quite considerable strength to pull the wire out of my mouth because it was being magnetized there. It's not so much painful as utterly astonishing. And in Morphy's case, it was because he played the game as it had never been played. Nobody knew what he was doing. He sacrificed pieces with brave abandon, not just one piece. He sacrificed 3 or 4. He placed them where you never expected them to be. He would allow you to put him within 1 move of checkmate, as if that 1 move were 10 moves. He beat his father once. I saw this game the other day, and I showed it to one of my students who likes chess. And my students just bowled over by the sheer beauty of it. He beat his father once by driving dad's king all the way across the board so that it was in the first row of the opponent's, right, so on the opponent's side, all the way across the board, and then delivering the checkmate by castling. Which I've never seen, right? Castle, checkmate. He seemed to think that the main use of his pawns was to get them out of the way. This is kill off your infantry so that we can let the artillery do its work. Bobby Fischer, a century later, is a boy genius, would say that in the open game there was still nobody who had anything to anything that would improve upon Paul Morphy. Nobody had anything to teach Morphy. For me to replay his games move by move is to feel an intense artistic delight, as if you could hold the wrist of young Michelangelo and feel every stroke of the chisel as he turns some great shapeless block of marble into the Pietà. The website categorizes hundreds of Morphy's games as chess variants, meaning that Morphy has spotted his opponent, one of his rooks, or a knight and a pawn, or whatever, and he still carves the man up into slices. And I imagine that plenty of men thought it was a privilege to be so dismembered. Now, nowadays, if you have a talent in chess these days, You hire a coach. They do. They hire coaches, and they bear down upon you day after day. They have you commit to memory all of the 200 or 300 standard openings and their variations. They instruct you in counting strategies for the pawns in the end game. But at that time, there were no such coaches. It was more blessed time. And Morphy, like the very similar genius Capablanca, learned chess from watching his father play. There's a lot of things that boys learn just by snooping. And he was otherwise self-taught. He was something of a lusus naturae, a freak or a play of nature, an odd move that nature makes on the chessboard, a move that is dangerous and bold, with a potential for magnificent success or abject failure. So there are several points I wish to make this morning about this, about the boy genius. There are actually 5 points. The first one is this: the boy genius is almost always a boy. And some of you may know that when it comes to IQ distributions, the curve is flatter in males than in females, which means that you get a greater percentage of males beyond the first standard deviation, beyond the second standard deviation on the upside, okay? By the third standard deviation, it's quite a larger percentage. But also on the downside, too, more males below the first deviation, below the norm, etc. I'm persuaded that we're not just talking about a high level of intelligence, though. It's not all that we've got here. We're not talking about some quality that allows you to succeed in school. It's very strange. We're talking about something that is like an electric shock. It's foreign, strange, unsettling, unpredictable. I give you some examples. Blaise Pascal's sister, and there were a lot of brains in that family, and Blaise himself believed that his younger sister was more intelligent than he was. But his older sister said that Blaise, as a small boy, played with conic sections the way that other children play with toys. And by the way, there are still unresolved questions regarding such things as conic sections, which the ancients knew about and played with. The shortest distance between 2 points on a cone. There is no mathematical equation that will give you that answer, believe it or not. So playing with conic sections is not like playing with triangles or something. Einstein lay on his belly on the brow of a hill in Tuscany, they say, and asked himself what the world would look like if he saw it while he was riding on a beam of light. He was a teenage kid when he said that. Alexander Pope said of his boyhood, "I lisped in numbers, for the numbers came." Numbers there means metrical English poetry. But it's fascinating to me that in the male mind, the poetry of old is associated with mathematics, with mathematical music. Tom Edison at 4 years old, and Edison was a bit of a piece of work, sat on a hen's egg to see if he could hatch it. Tom Edison had a very understanding mother. He actually did. Now, we fool ourselves if we say that we would enjoy being around such people. Enjoy is the wrong word. It's like saying that you would enjoy an electric shock, or you hope someday to experience a sudden tectonic shift, otherwise known as an earthquake. Basketball player Jerry Lucas, this is quintessentially male, okay, and not, in this case, not in a pleasant way. Once set himself to memorize the Manhattan telephone directory. For those of you who are under age 40, a telephone book was it listed all the phone numbers of people in alphabetical order. If anybody here is from University of Illinois, a book is a thing that Anyway. Does anyone remember that Jerry Lucas tried to do that? Because I have a memory of that from my boyhood, yeah. I don't know whether he succeeded in it. I do know that he kept in his mind a running tally of the statistics for every player in every single NBA game that he played, going so far as to pester the scorers in the middle of the game to make sure to whom they had awarded an assist. Okay? That's something you would only associate with something freakish in the masculine constitution. Lucas was a great player who nobody seems to have liked. And not because he was bad on the court in any obnoxious way, but because of this. I won't make any claims about myself, but I noticed that I too do some of the things that you would associate with the male sex when it comes to this sort of craziness. 25 years ago, I set myself to memorize Paradise Lost, which is, I don't know, about 14,000 lines long. And I did it in the summer, and I got into book 5, and then school started, and I had to put it down. But in my retirement, I know, I still have hundreds of lines up there. I'm going to do that because my graduate school professor's neighbor in Saskatchewan used to recite Paradise Lost to himself while he was plowing. That's the kind of thing that some crazy guys will do. The mathematician Henri Poincaré, who's also a piece of work, would lose himself utterly in mathematical calculation, pace back and forth in his room. He'd be oblivious to everything around him. Story goes that a young mathematician traveled all the way, I believe it was from Sweden, it might have been from the Low Countries, I think it was from Sweden, to Paris to speak to Poincaré. He had written him a letter, he had announced that he would show up there, Poincaré had responded to the letter. He shows up at his apartment, his name is announced, but Poincaré didn't seem to hear. And when the poor man finally cleared his throat and attempted to say something, the great man turned on him in complete surprise and bellowed out, "What are you doing here?" The visitor was so overwhelmed by this that he rushed out of the room and he went straight back across the North Sea. I hope we recognize that this sort of thing is, as I said, peculiarly masculine. It's not only associated with males, that is, you don't just see it more frequently in males. There's something masculine about the phenomenon itself. It's this absorption, giving yourself up completely to something grand to be done, even if it's something stupidly grand, like memorizing the Manhattan telephone book. Think of characters, for instance, from scripture itself. Who goes forth into the desert and eats grasshoppers and wild honey and has one thing in his mind and seemingly one thing alone to prepare the way of the Lord and make straight his path? A kind of really powerful, angular monomania, okay, in the Baptist. In some of its manifestations, it resembles what we now call autism. And I think if we look back in history, we can point to various male geniuses that probably would have been characterized in this way now, like, for instance, Michelangelo. One of my philosophy, and so autism obviously afflicts more boys than girls. I don't want to get into the question of why my son is autistic. I have a personal stake in this. One of my philosophy professors at Princeton, a man named Saul Kripke, I'm not sure if he's still alive, maybe perhaps somebody knows, he wrote a dissertation that was so subtle and penetrating, I think it was on the question which exercised him throughout his career, why we can or why we perhaps cannot call a thing that has changed over time by the same name. Okay, what makes it the same thing even though it has changed? only 4 or 5 people in the world were considered qualified to grade it or even to read it and understand it. This is one of the nicer things that I can say about my Mater Ferox, Princeton. They shrugged and said, well, what the heck? We'll just give him the doctorate. And they hired him, right? When he lectured, he showed why certain rumors regarding his table habits were true. So there was a rumor going around that literally his wife at the dinner table had to put food in his mouth, had to feed him. So Kripke would prowl about the front of the room. I won't do this because I've got a microphone in front of me. But he would make goose-like honking noises. Oh, 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 like that. And it would go on for about 40 seconds. Honk, honk, honk. It took the form of a stutter. He'd be smiling. He totally innocent of any impression that he might be giving, right? And then he'd spurt out, Barclay, meaning Bishop Barclay from the 18th century, Barclay, Barclay. And then he'd go on a minute or two spritz of absolute brilliance, okay? And then the machine would run down, have to be wound up again. And the honks would resume. And they would occasionally be punctuated by a drink of water, which one of the graduate students was enjoined to keep handy for him so that he could wet the whistle. The graduate student would bring the water to him. Kripke would take a sip of it and would dribble down his beard. It would. He would wipe it with his sleeve. It was the grossest thing that you would ever see in a classroom. It was phenomenal. Class was phenomenal. I have never in my life seen a woman behave like that. Have you? And I notice, right, that the people around men like this, and there are men like this, I think the old television producer and director Stephen Botchko was like this. People around them take it in stride. It's the sort of thing that you find in men, but in these cases you find it to a pronounced degree. I think, for instance, of men who use the bathroom to read and to pore over atlases, old copies of National Geographic. Thomas Aquinas must have been this way. I love the anecdote that's told about him at the court of the king, Louis IX, that Saint Louis IX, one of the saintly figures from the Middle Ages. Louis was a friend of Thomas, Brother Thomas. So there he would invite him sometimes to the royal table. There'd be lords and ladies round about. They'd talk about the things that lords and ladies talk about. Thomas, of course, would not be part of the conversation at all. They'd be partaking of their venison and their soup and their bread, which Thomas did partake of. He was notably a big man. His brothers, I am also told, at their refectory, carved a crescent out of the table to help Thomas fit in. One day he was there. They're all talking. They're all doing the social thing. He is completely lost in concentration. Suddenly he bangs his fist on the table, which is a considerable fist, and cries out, "Thus are the Manichaeans refuted." And the king called a page boy over and said, "Go fetch Brother Thomas some pen and paper," which he did. Grant me then my point about probability. Of course, now I'd have all the feminists at my throat. How dare you bring mathematical facts into this discussion here? It's all social. Second point is that it makes good sense that it should be so. And every once in a while, I pick up an ally from Darwinism, of all places. Stark variations from the norm or the median come in nature at considerable expense. It's not just a stereotype, the business about the extremely intelligent boy who is physically frail, right? It is really more likely that that boy will have physical problems with him. If you're a member of Mensa, you shouldn't be, but if you are, it's more likely than not that your constitution is compromised by some oddity. You are left-handed, it's a disproportionate number of them, by largely disproportionate, or lefties. Your eyesight is bad, perhaps. You suffer very severe allergies, or your immune system is in some ways compromised, right? These come at a price, right? The genius is far more likely to be dead by age 40 than is his merely smart and well-built cousin. He may well be dead by his own lapses in noticing things around him. And this stereotype goes all the way back to the ancient world. I've told my students that a philosopher is a man who, if he is walking in an open field with a flagpole in the middle of it, will find a way to walk into that flagpole. A good friend of mine back at Providence College, where I used to do, I call it St. Eustoby Catholic College, would be seen occasionally, he had something of the Kripke in him, would be seen occasionally walking across campus arguing with himself and losing the argument and shaking his head while he was doing so. The philosopher, the ancient philosopher Thales, who, by the way, was a very shrewd man, so this was a little bit of a slander on Thales. Thales noticed something about the growth of olive trees. It made him a killing in the olive oil market one year. But Thales is said to have fallen into a ditch right in front of him because he was too lost in contemplation of the heavens. That's a typical charge against philosophers. I think there's some truth to it there. The male genius is going to be many times notably oblivious to things very nearby. The genius may be dead by his own experiments. Benjamin Franklin should not have lived to tell about his adventure with lightning, a kite, and a metal key. He shouldn't have lived. It stands to reason that if you want your clan to survive, you had better not have such people among the females. Your children will die. They'll be in the jaws of the tiger before their theoretical mothers would notice. The adrenal systems of women, I've been told, and by the way, this might have something to do with the execrable movement in our time, the Me Too movement. The adrenal systems for women have two settings, danger and no danger, okay? So my wife gets very jumpy in the car when something happens over there as I'm driving. I have already noticed it and have classified it as not big deal. I notice some men are nodding here. Of course, I've also classified it in my mind as very likely not big deal. And that's not good enough for my wife, that it's very likely not a big deal. Well, you don't want people who are to take care of small children to be calculating odds and weighing risks. You certainly don't want them to be lost in the haze of a couple of thousand lines of poetry composed in their minds. Children would die. Homer would have been blind even if he had not been blind. Mozart said his father was blind in just that way. He could see in the sense that the light struck his eyeballs, but he did not see. A murder might be committed 10 feet away from him, and if he was in the middle of composition, he might not notice. And here are a couple of masculine currents coincide. I remember this story because I read it when I was 5 years old in the old Childcraft encyclopedia things that we got. My parents, one of the best things they ever did for me was to buy a World Book Encyclopedia and Childcraft when I was five, so we had books in the house. And still remember the story about how little boy Mozart was accused of theft because his father had taken him to the one of the Holy Week services at the Vatican, where the polyphonic music by Gregorio Allegri was being sung, and nobody had written the score for this down. It was passed down from choirmaster to choirmaster over the generations, and was considered kind of like a special secret, a state secret. Well, all Mozart had to do was hear it once, and he knew what all the voices were doing, right? Six different voices. When it came out that this boy had done it, it was thought that some theft was involved. I don't know how that works because it hadn't been written down, but he was accused of theft and brought before the Pope. And Mozart's father tried to explain. He said, my son can't have done this because he can't see. Well, does it mean he's blind? No, he's not blind, but he can't see. He only hears, okay? And the Pope tested Mozart by having somebody play some complicated piece of music on the harpsichord and ask Mozart, the boy, if he could replicate that. And Mozart played the piece, having never seen it before and having only heard it one time, played it flawlessly. That was the Mozart family way of getting in good with the Pope. You don't want that person to be taking care of children. Mozart could compose in between billiard shots. It's another story regarding him, that he'd be shooting billiards while composing. But that's because the activities are very similar. Perhaps men are more likely to see this, that the arrangement of angles, a multitude of angles going this way and that, is rather like the arrangement of musical concussions and ricochets. Nature is conservative with females because to them is given the whole biological future of the race, but she can be devil-may-care with males because demographically they are expendable. If Johnny blows himself up while trying to invent nitroglycerin, he, as a father to children, may easily be replaced. And some other Johnny will invent the stuff instead. I am reading right now a book that I picked up at our town book exchange, otherwise known as the town dump. People bring their recyclables. They also bring books, and they put them in boxes inside the recycling building, and you can just go in there and pick up books. It's an interesting glance into what's happening to our culture, that at such a place you can find, as I did, a complete set of hardcover editions of the complete works of George Eliot. Just waiting there for somebody to pick up. That's what I picked up one day and a different day, a complete set hardcover, circa 1900, of the works of Washington Irving. But evidently some old person dies, and what do you do with all the books? Well, the generations to come are not reading them, so they go to the dump for somebody like me to pick up. Anyway, I picked up a book by an Irishman who grew up in hand-to-mouth poverty, but actually rather jovial and physically robust poverty in Northwest Ireland, describing his boyhood. and how one time, for instance, the men were hunting seals that were inside a cave out in a sort of semi-island off the coast, so that you had to go underwater to get into the cave in this rock where the seals were. Go there, and you won't like this, but bludgeon them to death. These people were lucky if they survived the winter. Bludgeon them to death, and then somehow get hundreds of pounds of seal, each seal weighing 300 or 400 pounds. The cows would weigh that, and the bulls would weigh more, to get them then from that place, underwater, out of the cave, and into a boat. Okay? And only people who half don't care whether they live or die, because it's fun to do these things, and who are extremely inventive with weird expedients, like what to do in case there are seals in a sealed-off cave, and you have to go underwater to go fetch them. Only they who do something like that. And in fact, one of the men nearly lost his life. But then they always seemed in this town in Ireland to be doing such things, which required a sort of aggressiveness and inventiveness. And again, I would say, you don't want those people to be taking care of children. Third point that I want to make is built on the second, and it has to do with institutions, right? Edison was a compulsive worker. He was about as antisocial a man as you could be. He was a terrible father. Never spent any time with the kids at all. I don't know if he could have, if it was in his emotional makeup. He taught himself to sleep an hour or two at night on his laboratory table. Nobody ever called upon Michelangelo for the charm of his wit, although he wrote poetry and was, in fact, a very witty man. He was a fiery and brooding man. If you ever look at Raphael's painting of the School of Athens, you'll see Michelangelo portrayed as, it's a portrait, it's a nice tribute that Raphael gives to his competitor, a portrait of Michelangelo in the foreground alone and thinking. Rodin had that posture in mind, I believe, when he sculpted his famous statue of the Thinker, thinking like this with the knee bent and the hand on the face, but alone. Sometimes you get a jolly, semi-autistic fellow, like Chesterton, once sent a telegram to his wife in London, saying simply, his wife is living in London, he's in London, he sends a telegraph to his wife. In Piccadilly now, where should I be? He was a social fellow. But more often, you don't get that. And if that's the case, and perhaps even in Chesterton's case, too, an institution is the last place where you may expect the boy genius to thrive, unless that institution possesses certain features, which I'll come to later. But in the main, it's not the place for it. For now, I'll assert that the boy genius suffers in two or three ways. At the institution called school. First, the unruliness of genius suffers. But perhaps I ought to catch myself up here a little bit and say that the genius isn't simply unruly, but is following rules, and sometimes maniacally following them, that the institution doesn't recognize. The unruliness of the boy suffers. And again, I think I need to catch myself up here. It's not simply that the boy dislikes rules, but perhaps this kind of boy has in mind rules for something that would be literally magnificent, to make something big and great, which of course cannot be done in most institutions. Most institutions are not for doing that. The whole aim of the school weighs upon such a boy like fog. The purpose of our large social stewing pots, our schools, is to sink the genius to equality, that is, to the mediocre, and to raise the half-wit to the same standard. In this enterprise, I say that they win one and they lose one. They cannot succeed with the half-wit, but they do succeed with the genius. They muffle, stifle, dishearten, and bore. When equality is the aim and an enforced conformity is the means, then genius retires, sullen and idle. Here I am reminded of what C.S. Lewis said about equality for us. Because of our fallen nature, equality is medicine, not food. It's medicine because, frankly, we can't trust any of our fellows with too much authority, too much power. Medicine and not food. I will just add here that if equality is taken as food, that is, if it is ingested in more than small quantities, it, like other medicines, becomes not even medicine, but poison. Most of the girls I knew when I was a kid liked school well enough. I knew only one of them who hated it with a passion. Most of the people I knew who hated school with a passion, as I did, were boys. And I did not really know a single boy who actually liked school. And this should not surprise us. The boy's body is that of a big and active dog. It needs acreage. This is a physical fact. The people who run the schools in our time are women, and they run it to their tastes and not to his. Their tastes run to the safe space, the walled garden, something there is that does not love a wall and wants it down, said Robert Frost, who also disliked school and spent most of his time in it as a child, whittling and otherwise not paying attention to the goings-on. I got this from the curator at the Frost Farm in Derry, New Hampshire. I have not been able to verify it, but she said that he hardly knew how to read before he was 13 years old. Now that boy would be drugged. And that, of course, means that we would not have the poetry that he then produced after the drugging. Our schools are places of routine and sociability, which means practically that they are snake pits of gossip and sinkholes of drudgery. Yet the cheerfulness of young people somewhat lightens the mood, and also the genuine goodwill and the genuine kindness of the women who teach there. There is occasional charm in the fog. But genius is what it is in part because it cannot be taught in any easily predictable or convenient way. It resists industrialization, even if that comes with a feminine smile. If you are in most social environments, with one exception that I'm going to get to, I promise, if you're in most social environments, you have to abide by a kind of complicated etiquette, which is good. It's a good thing in itself. It's remarkably effective. It does redound to human happiness, this etiquette. And it prevails in our schools. Maybe it's not nice in our schools anymore. But it doesn't redound to the happiness of the poor, befuddled boy, to whatever extent he is afflicted by this malady that I am calling genius. The institution, by its nature, exists to continue. That's it. It's like a granite cliff. It's there. But something in the boy wants to act upon the cliff. His mind drives a wedge into its heart. Quarry it for granite. Blow a hole through it so that a train can rumble through. Set charges of dynamite in it to carve a massive sculpture. Young men's thoughts are bold, says the poet Spencer. It was not a controversial statement to make back then. The boldness fits with their bodies and with their felt need to show themselves as strong and desirable for women. They're like the bright cardinal, not the one in the Archdiocese of Chicago, but the one who sings loudly. These cardinals are sweet little songbirds with not much in their heads. I also like the St. Louis Cardinals ever since I was 8 years old. and I can name 760 of its players, the team's players, since 1967. The boys of the bright cardinal singing upon an open branch. Give a boy an axe, and he will chop down trees with it, just for fun. And it is fun. If we had not become used to such phenomena, so used to them that we no longer even notice them, there's no way that most of us could imagine doing something as bizarre as, let's say, this comes from the place where I grew up, digging a canal through the mountains that separate the Delaware River from the Hudson, as did the first settlers of the towns where I grew up in Pennsylvania, so they could float barges of coal to New York City without going through Philadelphia. Fine madness grips the man. The Wright brothers at Kitty Hawk were like the first man who strapped an ox to his own shoulders and a blade to scrape up the earth, or like the first man who culled a young wild ox from the herd. No institution as an institution would invent a plow. By the time the first semi-savage boy with an idea and an ox had gotten through the layers upon layers of approval, the ox would be dead, and the boy would be off in the woods on his own, half-starved and sullen and of no use to anyone. My fourth point hinges upon this difference between the institutional space that women enjoy and the space that men enjoy. Of the former, I call to witness the feminists themselves. Let's imagine that you have the run of a library filled with the greatest works of the human mind, works by Plato, Shakespeare, Dostoevsky, Gibbon, Dr. Johnson, Goethe, Homer, and so on. Suppose you were invited every week to lectures by the world's most insightful critics of these works. Suppose they engaged the most difficult questions that have perplexed mankind, difficult and momentous. Do we possess free will? Are the good and the true convertible with one another? What's the nature of matter? Is evil an existent thing, or is it a mere negation? Is the common good identifiable with the good of individuals? What is the whole duty of man? Now suppose that instead of reading those books and attending those lectures, you demand that a new wing of the library be built, where you and members of your sex who believe as you do, not all the members of your sex, but certain ones, at the monetary expense of men as well, where you can retire to read Charlotte Perkins Gilman, Kate Chopin, Andrea Dworkin, Rosemary Ruther, and Margaret Atwood, and that the questions you engage all have to do with the status of women in your time. You make it clear, in addition, that only certain opinions will be entertained. For instance, the opinions of Marianne Griswold van Rensselaer, one of the leaders of the opposition to woman suffrage in the United States, and she was quite a woman. She was the most prominent critic of art and architecture in her time of either sex. She need not apply for admission. That's an institutional safe space. It's a feminist quilting bee, except that nothing so attractive and useful as a quilt is ever made. Now, it should go without saying that most men and boys would find such a place intolerable. Liberal men and boys would find that place, I think, intolerable. But that's part of what I'm trying to say here. Men and boys would also not enjoy other classes taught by those women who would establish those things. The women do not speak their language. I don't need to show here that no woman can inspire boys intellectually. In general, I notice a fact. They do not do it. I'm not blaming them for that, no more than I would blame them for not inventing new sports, which boys and men invent all the time. I assume that the interests of the sexes are not identical because the sexes are not identical. If someone should object, that say that I'm wrong and boys are surely inspired to greatness by their women teachers, I must shrug. I'm speaking in the general case. I'm not speaking universally here. I'm speaking in the general case. I have to shrug and ask why the same boys then lag so badly behind their sisters who come from exactly the same families as they do, same social status, same income, go to the same schools. and are in the aggregate possessed of no greater natural intelligence than their brothers, right? But they're the same. Whether it could theoretically happen that we get a Bach or a Michelangelo from a system dominated by women, I don't know. But then I also don't know whether it is theoretically possible for a man to live on Mars. I know that it does not happen, and it is not happening. We don't speak the same language. I give you an obvious example. When we are dealing with any assertion, but our colleges are filled with this, right, what I'm about to describe, any assertion beyond what is merely technical or logical, the woman will think of a dozen ways in which this assertion is consequential for the welfare of human beings, including herself. The first question that the man will think of is simply this: is it true? And again, I call to witness the feminists. They are the ones who first showed me that it was masculine, all too masculine, to insist upon truth before all other considerations. They are the ones who, with a sneer, call it logocentric. But this is also a part of the attack against the Christian faith, too. Or phallocentric. I have no idea what a urethra has to do with whether a certain statement happens to be true or false. I have no idea. Some other such nonsense. While calmly typing away in their offices inside buildings constructed by men who never inquired about the feelings of brick or the social implications of angular momentum, but made their angles right and their walls plumb and their levels true. Feelings are neither here nor there, right? I mean, men will say to one another in the male space, you are not permitted to let your feelings get in the way of our question here, whether X is true or not. Your feelings, if you have them, you keep them to yourself because we've got something bigger at stake here. If English literature, take it all in all, is superior to Welsh literature, as much as I like the Welsh, then it is, and that is that. Calling the attitude fascist or imperialist may mask your fear to acknowledge the truth, but the truth remains. I'll tell you a little anecdote. Am I going over time, Jim? I don't want to. I'm okay. All right. Just 25 years ago. I'm at a party at the hosted by the Modern Language Department at St. Eustaby Catholic College. And I'm thinking in classical male fashion. We're the sex that invents metrics to decide which baseball players are greater than who's greater than who. This player played in the 1920s, this player played in the 1990s. They never even faced each other. How do we judge, right? So I decide award first place to various of the national literatures from one century to the next, from the 12th century on. And I like this because I stumble around in a lot of languages and I read these literatures. And so 12th century is French, 13th century is French, 14th century is obviously Italian by a wide margin. It's the Dante, Petrarch, Boccaccio century. 15th century is Italian, 16th century is either Spanish or English. 17th century is English, 18th century is French or German, 19th century is Russian, 20th century perhaps Spanish. And a woman professor overhearing this, it was really agitated, and she was a nice woman, she's not a crazy person. And she said, I do not understand why this fascist talk. That was circa 1993 that happened. So I'm just being a guy, you know? You can rank quarterbacks. It's not fascist ranking quarterbacks. And your feelings have nothing to do with it. Your feelings have nothing to do with it. Your personal feelings regarding the relative merits of Johnny Unitas and Joe Montana have nothing to do with anything. Which leads me to the point I've been building towards. I've said that boys may flourish in an institution if the institution has a certain characteristic. I've said that, and now I'm going to reveal the characteristic, and you probably know what's coming. It's that the institution should be a patriarchy or a fraternity, in the big sense of that word. I don't know whether every mother wants her daughter to be greater than she is. I do not know whether women think in such comparative terms. I actually have a sense that they don't. I know that every good father wants his son to be a better man than he has been. We get this in the ancient pagan world. There's the famous scene in the Iliad, where Hector has come back within the walls of Troy, and he meets his wife Andromache, who is holding their little baby son. And baby son is scared by the plume on Hector's helmet, which, you know, it's kind of frightening. It's different. And the husband and wife laugh. He takes his helmet off, and he takes up the little boy in his arms, and he says that he hopes in days to come that men will say, "This man's father, Hector, he was a good man, but this man, is a far greater man than Hector was." And that is almost the essence of what every father wants for his son. And it's a fact attested to by every culture, okay? My father said it of me. Archie Manning says it of his boys, Peyton and Eli. This attitude is not sentimental. It doesn't necessarily imply softness. Men are the sex that builds the military space, the palestra, the arena for fighting. And you can fight with your mind as well as with your fists. G.K. Chesterton, an admirer of women, right? A bluff admirer of women, who said of women that they can do pretty much anything or everything, a little bit of everything, where it's you have to exercise all of your force to get a man to do one thing. Right? That was Chesterton. Said that there are only three things that women do not understand. They are liberty, equality, and fraternity. All three things, as he defines them, come together in the club, the beer hall, the boxing ring, and the school for boys that is run by men. In such a place, no question is out of bounds. Social rank does not matter. Right? It's just got inequality here. It's an equality of the boxing ring. Feelings do not weigh in the balance with truth. So you have that liberty there. Anything and everything may be discussed. Nobody gets to say thus far and no farther when it comes to intellectual battle. Thus far and no farther because the question makes me feel bad. Or the proposed answer makes me feel bad. The boys and men fight it out with ideas as with fists. And oftentimes they're all the more firmly bound to one another for the gift of a bloody nose. It's a fraternity that makes such a place possible, and such a place reinforces the goodness and the strength of the fraternity. You notice the kind of thing that men in the Middle Ages who invented the university, which was a fraternity, it's a guild, invented for the proving of bachelors. It was an intellectual boxing ring in public, Paris. It would be held in public. The masters and the doctors would ask questions of the bachelor, and the object of their scrutiny would answer them as best he could, while everybody who was interested or everybody who wanted to watch a good show or a good fight would look on and judge the performance, just as the fans at Madison Square Garden might score the fight on their cards. It was not just a concluding ceremony for, you know, their years in the university. It was the most public manifestation of what had been going on in the university all the time. That's the sort of thing they did within their walls, fighting it out with ideas, with the mind, fighting it out against not just each other, but against past writers. Thomas Aquinas was given by his fellow students the unflattering nickname, and as boys do this to each other all the time, it's often affectionate and unflattering at the same time, given the nickname the dumb ox. But that Thomas threw a mean uppercut and a crushing right cross with blows of the mind. This sort of fraternity, this not safe space, this dangerous space, okay, for controlled danger. what allowed the monk Gaunilo to attempt to rebut St. Anselm's proof of the existence of God on behalf of the fool who says in his heart, there is no God. And Anselm did not take the rebuttal personally. He did not cast doubt upon Gaunilo's faith, but he gave him arguments right back. Under the protection of the fathers and of the father himself, the sons could fight and grow strong and thresh out the truth from error and falsehood. Now, I have no reason to doubt, the biologist in me, the logician in me, there's no reason to doubt that nature is providing us with as many boy geniuses now as she ever did. If we don't see them, it's because we've stifled them. Where would they flourish? Where would they go to be free? Where can they build their catapults to hurl half a mountain against the massive complacency that surrounds them? Where will they learn to see their gifts as an expression of their masculine nature, ordained to serve the common good? Name the place where they would flourish. There isn't any. So then the places must be built again. It's hardly necessary for me to argue that men alone must do this. Only men have done it, and the women of our time, and not, they're not necessarily like the women of 100 years ago. I read the writings of women 100 years ago. The women of our time do not show the slightest interest in it, but rather the reverse. But the work is now three generations overdue to rebuild reading groups for men, but schools for boys, guilds for young men, and universities. Because the university as it was invented and as more or less survived well into the 20th century is dead. It needs to be built again. And it may have to be built by men specifically for men before it can do anything beyond that. It's three generations overdue, and it's time to get to it. Thank you.